I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. On this edition of Parallax Views, we take a break from our coronavirus COVID-19 pandemic coverage for a previously unpublished conversation with author and artist James Curcio, whose new book, Masks, Bowie and Artists of Artifice, came out back in January and featured contributions from such thinkers as John Gray, author of the notorious Straw Dogs, and Slavoj Žižek, among others. There's even an interview with previous Parallax Views guest and scholar of the esoteric, Gary Lockman. In Masks, Bowie and Artists of Artifice, James and other writers interrogate the sort of shamanic character of David Bowie, the late musician known for having an ever-evolving and almost trickster-like persona that often blurred the lines between the artificial and the authentic. What's interesting about this book is that its interrogation of Bowie also deals with other figures such as the gonzo journalist Hunter S. Thompson and the controversial Japanese novelist and poet Yukio Mishima. And it does this all from the vantage of a philosophical inquiry. In this conversation, James and I discuss Masks, Bowie, Artists of Artifice, and the themes it tackles in what I believe is a rather fascinating discussion that should be of interest even for those who aren't fans of the late musician. And now, on to the conversation with James Curcio, editor of Masks, Bowie and Artists of Artifice. Welcome to Parallax Views, James Curcio, author of the upcoming book, Masks, Bowie and Artists of Artifice. I should say author or editor or a little bit of both.
A little bit of both. Yeah, I mean, I was the editor for it and kind of helped get the group together of contributors. But I also wrote a chapter and the intro and the end piece. So both, yeah.
Well, before we get into the book, maybe we could talk a little bit about your background, because mm-hmm. the way you approach Bowie is essentially as an artist, you yourself being an artist, and also from a sort of philosophical and even occultic lens at times. Maybe you could describe how you sort of came to a background in those areas.
Yeah, sure. I mean, actually, it's kind of a lead into how I got into the book itself. So I'll actually start there and jump back because, you know, his last album, Black Star, when it came out, well, I mean, even before it came out 2 days before he died, but even before, you know, I watched the video for it right when it came out, and I was taken by it because it dealt really heavily with the concept of death, which runs through all of his artwork. And then he actually died, and that changed the framing of it, you know, and a lot of people interpreted that as being, you know, well, he was trying to create a, you know, kind of an art piece as his final send off. He didn't actually know he was going to die, but it still created, that illusion, you know, of him sort of, giving his, you know, great work a final push. And it kind of called in all these sort of occultic ideas from his earlier work, especially stuff in the mid 70s. And so my own development as an artist was at various points informed by Bowie's approach and his philosophy. Almost more than loving the music. I mean, I did like music, some more things more than other, but it was more with how he engaged with other creative people. And also how much his work is based around the idea of, you know, your sort of narrative identity or your persona, you know, and the malleability of it, especially in the public eye. So, you know, it kind of all gelled, and the concept for the book happened very quickly. Of course, researching it and developing it took a much longer time, but, you know, the concept was right there. So when I was, I guess when I was like 16 or so was when I first really, connected with him. And that was when he was, touring and working with Trent Reznor.
I'm afraid of Americans, right?
Yeah, I mean, that was on the subsequent album, but it was still part of the same sort of collaboration. They were working pretty closely together for a little while. So, you know, I mean, of course I was familiar with like his earlier stuff, Changes and Ziggy and whatnot, but, you know, so that was really what drew me in as a teenager, and then kind of retroactively going back into his work. And like I said, it really was so much about his ability to kind of get other people to, you know, work, you know, in original ways. And, you know, like when he worked with one group of people, you know, he would kind of have a certain sound, a certain approach, and then he'd get different group of people together and it would change. And people think of him as a chameleon, and in some ways he was, but it was as much the people he surrounded himself with and worked with. You know, it's a Bowie in a way, it was almost like an amalgamation, like a, a fictional construct itself. Yeah, so that's where the idea of masks started, and that's where it started for me.
Well, if we could back up maybe even a little bit further, I feel as if masks relates to some of your prior work. I think the running theme in all of your work, whether it's been your novels or your work with podcasts, I think that the defining thread has been an interest in what could be called modern mythology. And I say modern not only because you have used that term, but because it seems apropos, especially given that when most people say mythology, they're thinking of Zeus and Hera, and that's about it, and Hercules, and those kind of stories. But you look at mythology in a much broader sense.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was partially to make that distinction. Although, of course, you know, modern myth can still engage with older ideas of myth because we're still bringing it into our current milieu. So, like for instance, like Gaiman's American Gods or something like that. You know, it still is dealing with kind of mythology in a more traditional sense, but it's still modernized. I guess we should probably clarify what we mean by myth. So, like myth is a collective story that kind of binds people together through that narrative, but whether or not they actually believe in it, you don't have to believe, you know, in the content of a myth for it to affect you and change you. So to a certain extent, it's, you know, kind of a broad interest in stories, but it's more than just kind of story. It's about the way, like a narrative identities themselves construct the stories that we tell about ourselves and about each other. So it's that interplay between fiction and nonfiction, or fiction and reality. You know, it's malleable, but it's not one-to-one. And so there's a lot to plumb in there. And so, yeah, it's kind of been the ongoing thread in my work. I also, you know, for a while was working kind of as an indie producer and working in music too. I think that probably, I mean, actually getting involved in production was somewhat spurned on by outside as well. And I mean, also by Trent Reznor and some of the other people that I got into in that period when I was in high school.
So, like me, you were very much in the industrial scene.
Yeah. I mean, especially back then. You know, I still have a certain fondness for it now. But, you know, at the time, it was kind of my main aesthetic interests. I mean, of course, I had other interests other than, you know, wearing black and listening to weird music. But yeah, what elements of industrial were you engaging with?
I was into like stuff like Ministry. I got into Godflesh when I first started college. Nine Inch Nails was sort of an entry point, and then from there I started getting into like Throbbing Gristle, SPK, and a lot of the older stuff. Coil. I love Coil. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, their ability to kind of play with your consciousness. There's actually a side story, but I went to a dentist who let you play, you know, whatever music you wanted to kind of like calm you down or whatever. And so I brought in Coil's Time Machines. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but it was on for 5 minutes and he just stops the drill and he's like, I'm sorry, but this is like putting me into such a trance. I'm afraid I'm going to like do damage if we don't turn this off.
That's funny. Isn't that the album with all the tracks are named after drugs?
I think so, yeah. It's been a while, but it definitely, I mean, it definitely has that effect, that sort of binaural beat effect. So Coil was definitely one of the main entrance points for me in terms of exploring more with sort of experimental music.
Well, you know, I actually think this is a good segue into this conversation about the persona versus the real person, because Coil's John Balance, one of the two members, he was sort of known as like a spooky pagan industrial guy, and yet he had a Catholic funeral. It almost seems like to contradict the persona he had on stage, and I think we see that with a lot of artists.
Yeah, I mean, Bowie kind of made a career out of talking about that, or you know, with his work. But it's certainly affects really all artists to some extent. I mean, there's two general kind of currents with this, and I deal with this a little bit in the book. You know, there are artists who, in some way, they're either themselves, like their persona, or you know, a fictional character. Either way is kind of engaged in the work, and that's people in the public know the artist through that. And the other side of people who kind of try to remove themselves from their work, you know, sort of blank canvas sort of thing, where you try to minimalize your own involvement in it. I think in some extent, like John Cage was trying to experiment with that, trying to randomize everything so that the artist is almost secondary, you know, death of the author, that sort of thing. You know, and so we're dealing more with the first case, but I mean, at least it's my contention that really, even if an artist tries to remove themselves from their work, to the extent that their work gets known, that work replaces, you know, them. And that's really why masks is the term that we're using. It's not necessarily someone who's consciously like wearing a mask or playing a persona. It's more that you can't put something out into the public without, you know, without it being engaged with in the context of that thing that you're putting out. And people know that. They don't know you. Even if they come to know you afterwards, it's still kind of been filtered through that thing. And, you know, I experienced a small part of that myself, but it certainly informed it of, you know, people who read my novels or whatever and kind of met me through that. And it's a different, I mean, you know, eventually through, you know, friendship and knowing someone, it can kind of fall into the background a little bit. But it definitely changes people's perception of who you are, for better and worse. You know, it depends.
Well, it's interesting, too, because I think the question of the sort of chameleon persona of David Bowie brings to mind the ways in which we're performative in everyday life. This is not just relegated to artists or sensations in the art world such as David Bowie. This is also very much something we can apply to, you know, everyone. I mean, as Shakespeare, I believe, once said, we're all actors, and the world's our stage.
It's true. I mean, I think the stage thing is an important element to it, because it's all about the context that something is performed within. So, you know, I mean, like example I give in the book is of cops and judges and that sort of thing, situations where our society sort of dictates what they are in the context of our involvement with them. But like, you know, someone can dress up like a cop and they don't have that same, they behave the same way, but, you know, they don't have that magic wand waved over them that they're actually a cop. But what's actually the difference, right? It's just how we treat them. You know, same with a judge. If you tell a judge, you know, if you tell a judge off and you get locked in jail, you know, it's like, how is it different from telling anyone else off? What gives them that authority? It's a social contract of sorts. And that's all a stage is, really. It's just kind of, or, you know, for that matter, in the occult sense, a magical circle. It's just, it's something that separates everything off from the rest of the world, you know, so you can change the context that you engage with it in.
Well, I guess that leads into maybe us dissecting the title a little bit more, Masks. You already gave a little bit of a peek into that, but what I really liked within this book is that you reference masks in multiple ways with multiple thinkers. You begin the book with a quote by Kobo Abe. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that quote and why you chose to open up the book with that.
I don't have the quote on hand, but it's basically was a quote from one of his books, Face of Another, where a guy is trying to, he's been horribly scarred and he's trying to get his face fixed, and he's having this conversation with a doctor where basically the doctor is saying to him that the face and the soul are actually you know, one and the same. And this actually ties into Yukio Mishima is an artist he's a writer who gets brought up a lot in the book, and he had a similar theory that aesthetics sort of external presentation, you know, is really in a sense all there is. You know, there's different ways of interpreting the surface of something in that way, you know, but there's no essence underneath it. That my first chapter in the book is called Masks All the Way Down, you know, and it's that idea of, you know, it's not just a mask and then a real face underneath it. It's different guises, you know, one kind of masking the other. By the way, persona itself, the word is, I mean, actually is referenced to stage masks from Greek theater, which is like, persona is the mask that you sound through. It's the mask that you speak through. You know, you are using this sort of fiction to tell a truth about yourself that you couldn't otherwise tell.
Well, when we talk about fictions, I think what you're referring to is we're always creating fictions about ourselves, just by nature of the narratives we form and the stories we form about ourselves and about
others. Narrative identity. Yeah, that's what it's called usually in psychology.
What was that?
Like our narrative identity is usually how it's referred to in psychology. Yeah. Which is the story that we kind of use in our head to kind of create this sort of sense of, a permanent self, but something that persists through time, as opposed to these sort of, you know, probably more honest, you know, kind of fractured one thing and then another thing happens and they're tied together, you know, if at all, by this sort of different narratives as opposed to this one self narrative. So in a way, that's a fiction, yeah.
I see. And how did Bowie sort of engage with this idea or this metaphor of masks in his own work?
Sometimes really literally. I mean, he, you know, there are periods, especially in the 70s, where he wore makeup masks or actual masks or kabuki masks. He was really interested in kabuki theater for a little while. So there's sort of, you know, literal ways. But I think it almost got more interesting through the characters that he created. You know, he was really most of his career, he got trained in mimery when he was kind of starting out, and he was more interested in musical theater in a way than being being like a rock star exactly. Like it was, you know, creating personas in the context of a song or an album. You know, everyone knows him through these characters that he played in the lyrics, but they were fictional. And yet at the same time, this is what, you know, the thing I'm getting at, it's very hard for us to create a fiction without putting ourselves into it in some way. You know, actually role-playing is kind of tied into this too. I mean, I don't, to my knowledge, Bowie wasn't like really into D&D, I don't know. But the idea of, you know, playing a character in the sort of context of a game or whatever is very relevant to his work.
And how did the lines, in your opinion, begin to blur between the fiction that Bowie had created, and, you know, his diving into that full force?
That's a good question. And again, it was actually in the mid-70s. He was creating Persona. There was Ziggy, and then there was Aladdin Sane. And at the time, he was doing a great deal of cocaine. And I think that also kind of added to the blurred lines thing. And he seemed to lose himself in the characters more than a little bit. And I think the Thin White Duke was probably the kind of pinnacle of that, where he was locking himself away from pretty much everyone that he'd known previously, except for a couple of musicians that he was working with. And I mean, he said after the fact that, you know, it's surprising he survived that period. And I think given his consumption of drugs and not much else, it's probably pretty accurate. And the way he kind of came back was, I mean, the mythology is, and probably partially true, that he went to Europe and kind of rediscovered himself by stripping all that away. But really, the playing characters, you know, in his work didn't stop there at all. It's just that he over the next 20 years, got better and better at distancing himself. And Bowie, the character, became a sort of almost like a clothing rack or something. He could just put different, you know, hang different outfits on. You know, he's actually talked about this when he was doing the Outside project, that he'd gotten to the point finally where he could put on these characters and take them off without it being something he gets stuck in, debilitating. And I think part of that also was him finding kind of a balance between personal life and family life and his creative endeavors, which a lot of the other artists that we look at in the book, Yukio Mishima, Hunter S. Thompson, you know, they were not so successful at that. You know, Hunter is a great example of someone who kind of created a persona and then got stuck in it for the next 30 years or however many years. You know, and I wouldn't say it in itself killed him, but, you know, it definitely was a factor in his, you know, kind of being trapped and feeling like he had to take drugs to play the character, and of course being addicted to them.
Very similar to like Timothy Leary as well.
Yeah, in some ways. And Mishima was kind of an extreme case. I mean, really an extreme case in every way. But as opposed to kind of being stuck in a role, he actively like kind of wanted to use fiction to change himself. He wanted to become the sort of samurai, you know, ideal that he'd made for himself. And the ultimate pinnacle of that was, you know, to commit seppuku. So.
Well, let's stick on that for a second, if we can. How did you become so interested in Yukio Mishima?
Honestly, my, well, now ex-spouse is a librarian and very interested in Japanese culture. Their master thesis originally was going to be Japanese papermaking. And they just kind of passed one of his books my way. And that, what was the name of the movie?
Mishima, A Life in Four Chapters, Paul Schrader.
Yeah, that's right. They also like showed that to me, and it just, I don't know, something about him really clicked with me, and I mean, that's almost worrisome in a way, you know. And I think part of my fascination was that worrisome element of like, there's something about this guy that I really get, and God, that's you know, problematic, because he's, you know, he was a twisted person in some ways, you know, brilliant too. But,
well, maybe for my listeners that are not as familiar with Mishima, yeah, maybe you could go over a little bit of who he sort of was. I mean, you mentioned that he did this whole seppuku thing to end his life, but there's a lot more going on with Mishima than just
that. Oh, yeah.
That.
Yeah, for sure. You know, it's kind of the, you know, and in a way that's kind of was how he became, how he lost his fame. Because he was a very well-known novelist, especially in Japan, but even outside by the time that he died. And no one knows, you know, not no one, but a lot of people don't know him these days. I mean, he grew up in pre-war Japan. His grandmother basically kind of took control of his life and like kind of made him live with her. She was really sickly a lot of times. She had chronic pain and probably some mental illnesses as well. And that seemed to kind of be part of the starting point for him, of sort of having these fixations. He had really strong fixations, sort of aesthetic fixations on death. His poetry was, you know, and then writing was all kind of on this sort of glorification of, well, like, yeah, romantic ideals of it. It's one of those things where if you read it, you can kind of just immediately see what I'm talking about.
It makes sense that he would end up becoming essentially a political ultra-nationalist in Japan.
Ultimately, but for most of his life, he wasn't very political. And that's one of the things that I wanted to get into in the book, which I did because it's kind of relevant to now is, you know, he was a romantic and to a certain extent a nihilist. And then he became this, you know, ultra-nationalist. How did that progression take place? You know, so we kind of go through that. But one thing, I mean,
it's certainly very interesting. I mean, people forget at one point Mishima was starring in movies mm-hmm. in Japan. Like he was a big deal, as they say. And then, you know, all these years later, he's sort of forgotten.
Yeah. Also, I think his experience of World War II was certainly, you know, an effect. And in a way, it's like he had this fixation on sort of death as a kind of romantic ideal. And then, you know, World War II happened, and so he kind of felt like his personal mythology, if you will, was kind of being written outwards. Like he was felt really congruent with the age. And of course, like sort of fanaticism was really, you know, a thing during wartime Japan and World War II. But then afterwards, as the whole scenario changed very suddenly, and he felt very out of phase, you know, with what was going on with him. And I think that in some ways kind of progressed into him kind of forming this sort of ultra-nationalist reaction to it.
And this all culminates in him attempting a coup.
There's still a lot of debate about, to the extent that anyone's talking about him, still some debate about whether he was, like, how sincere. I mean, I think he was sincere in it, but and what happened is he kind of gave this speech in front of all these soldiers in a military base and, you know, over the sound of helicopters and whatnot, no one really could hear him give his speech. And the whole thing had this sort of tragic comic performance art element to it, you know, right up to the point where he killed himself. Although even there's still that sort of element to it. It's, you know, he was intending to actually to literally write in his own blood, but the pain was too much and he didn't, so he didn't get to write his final poem. But, you know, and that's speaking of someone being pretty extreme, it's, yeah.
You said he committed seppuku, so that's like when you commit suicide to save your own honor.
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated, but yeah. And what happened is he kind of disembowel yourself with a sword, and then your second cuts your head off so as to keep you from kind of disgracing yourself after that point. But unfortunately, his second, the strike hit his back. It didn't really properly sever his head, so then his second had to be, you know, had his head cut off as well because he'd failed in this task. So Mishima wasn't the only one who died that day.
Well, it's interesting because Mishima, I believe, if you look into his background, he's sort of noted as being like very shy, lanky, sort of, you know, like your stereotypical nerd or aspiring novelist. And yet, in later years, he becomes obsessed with bodybuilding and, you know, he even sort of almost talks down to the form of the novel and poetry and things like that later in his life with this obsession regarding, you know, physique and, you know, the perfect form of the body and all that kind of thing. And yet at the same time, he's so melodramatic about it that you almost feel like
it's another performance.
He's still that same person. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's definitely, it's easy to psychoanalyze these things, like, and maybe too easy. You know, like his father, was very, very critical. I mean, in his early writing career, his father was constantly ripping up his manuscripts and, you know, that sort of thing. So he definitely had, maybe not just from that, but just in general, had this sort of ambivalence towards, you know, towards his writing, and towards writing in general, and more wanted to become, as he put it, a real person. He wanted to become physically present, and the words, you know, like language itself was kind of a barrier to that. And One of his final books was called Sun and Steel, which deals with this, from his perspective. Although, like most of his books, the more autobiographical and the more honest seeming it is, in a way, also the more deceptive it is. You know, it's like it seems almost too calculated, too, you know, sort of pre-cooked, you know, pre-kind of conceived to really be exactly the whole of what's going on. That was true with his first book, too, Confessions of a Mask. So you're always wondering, you know, how much of this is him presenting this to us as the truth and how much of it is actually the truth. And that goes right to the heart of his work.
Well, I think we even see that in his suicide, essentially. I mean, it's very performative, and one wonders, is this sort of how he wants to present himself in his dying moments? Is there sort of a need to be seen in a certain way by the public? Do you sort of see what I'm getting at? Like, I think he wants to be seen romantically when he does that.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, it's one of the ironies is that he was trying to get away from you know, from the literary, and as a result, he concocted this incredibly literary end for himself that he then followed through on. So, I mean, yeah, it's ironic because he kind of did the exact opposite of what he was intending to do through it. Because you can't, you know, you can't look at that event and then look at the rest of his work and not find a connection there. I mean, he wrote a story and then actually acted out. The story was called Patriotism, where, you know, the main character commits seppuku, and he, in a movie, is committing seppuku. And then a couple years later, however many years later it was, he's doing it himself. I mean, you can't not draw the literary connection there, you know?
Do you think that Mishima's suicide was him trying to say, this is the sort of romantic myth that I want to go out on, that was maybe deliberate? Or do you think he just became consumed by the myths that he had created in the past?
I mean, honestly, I think it's both. You know, and there's also, you know, we can tell ourselves why we're doing something, and that isn't necessarily the reason why we're doing it. I don't know if we ever entirely know our own motivations. And that's another element of the whole mask idea is, you know, we're kind of, in a way, kind of playing to our own character, our own sense of who our character is, from moment to moment. But it's not, you know, based on this sort of fixed, you're just this and nothing else. It's permeable and it changes.
So if we can tie this back into Bowie, why do you feel that looking at Bowie through the lens of Mishima and also through Hunter S. Thompson sort of ties things together?
I mean, there's like the literal connections. Bowie was a fan of Mishima's, and he actually had a couple of tracks that kind of directly reference him. But also there's that thing I was talking about earlier where an artist, you know, or Bowie in particular, separated from his characters enough to kind of get this sort of distance that allowed him to have sort of a healthy, or at least relatively healthy home life and family life, you know, and life for himself for that matter, which Mishima and Hunter didn't. So part of it was kind of trying to draw that comparison. And as an artist myself and also starting to come into my middle age and kind of reaching that point where I'm kind of separating a little bit from my kind of past personas and, you know, kind of asking this question of, you know, how can you pursue art as your primary kind of focus in life and also trying to get it out into the world, but also keep a part for yourself. You know, you can't give everything away, right? It's important to draw that distinction for ourselves and not to be completely consumed by the, you know, not just by the work, but by the kind of person that we create in the work or through the work.
Well, it's interesting. I think we've gone around 40 minutes so far, and we still haven't talked about the subtitle, Artists of Artifice. Maybe we could talk about, what do you mean by artifice and art? What's the difference between the two? Maybe we could lay down some definitions.
Well, I mean, it's kind of a little bit of a wordplay because there's a connection. Although in the book we say that art is an act. I mean, it does something in the world, even if it's like sort of theoretical or conceptual or whatever. So the effect that it affects people, you know, it's an act. It's doing something. Artifice at least as we think of it on a sort of surface level, is, you know, something that's artificial, it's not real, right? And yet, like, Bowie is a great example of an artist who, you know, almost everything that he did was very calculated creatively. And, you know, it was artificial. It wasn't, you know, necessarily his true feelings or thoughts or whatever. And yet through that, you know, that's kind of a sense of sort of sense of truth in that. There's that wrestling idea of kayfabe.
Kayfabe.
Yeah, kayfabe.
Kayfabe. The language that separates the promoters and the wrestlers from the marks, or the people not in the know.
Right, exactly. But it's a sense of it's like emotional fidelity as opposed to sort of truth fidelity. You know, it's like, you know that wrestling is fake, right? But you still get wrapped up in the sort of truth of the feeling of it. You know, artifice is the same thing. And of course, this, I think, ties back into our current political situation. That's a whole, you know, topic unto itself. But the sort of, you know, politics as performance.
We have a reality TV star as president now, so yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Before that, we had a B-movie star called Reagan. Everyone always forgets, he was a B-movie star. He wasn't some A-list dude.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, honestly, Reagan wasn't entirely before my time, but I should spend more time kind of looking into his backstory these days to know it, especially with the weird overlap between Reagan and Trump's campaign. But anyways, that's a whole thing unto itself. Right.
I think these sort of theatrical elements have always been a part of the political landscape. I mean, when FDR couldn't do speeches in public, he would do the fireside chats, I guess, because he didn't want people to know about certain illnesses he may have had, or at least that's how I was sort of taught it in school. But I think there's always sort of a performative element going on within the political world.
Oh, no doubt. And of course, rhetoric is very great deal about performance. But I mean, I still think something has changed, especially to the extent that social media has become integrated with the political process. You know, the sort of performative elements have, at least to my opinion, have kind of overtaken everything else. It's not politics almost at all. It's almost entirely, you know, performative and aesthetic. You know, you like these people because of what they represent. You don't like these people because of what they represent. None of it's about, you know, who they are, even necessarily what those, you know, actual policies are or anything like that.
Yeah, a lot of the times I notice that it doesn't seem to necessarily be about who is right or what the truth is of a certain matter, but rather the person I like. I'm going to defend them because I like, you know, Andy No, or on the left, I'd have to think of someone, but I've seen people say, well, since I like this person, even though you've pointed out everything that's wrong about my support of this person, I'm still going to like believe everything they say. Yeah. I've seen that. You can see that online every day.
Sure. And it's that sense of emotional fidelity. I mean, it's like, you know, that it's how you feel about them because of that, you know, a sense of, I think, Colbert called it truthiness. Remember he coined that term, truthiness. You feel it in your gut. It might not be true, but it feels true in my gut. It feels true to me, even though I know it's not. It's become a great deal a part of our, you know, discourse, I guess you could say, if you want to use high flung language for it.
Well, it's interesting to me because I think we live in an age where the artificial is actually really looked down upon. You know, everyone wants to be quote unquote authentic. You know, in a way, Bowie's out, and I don't know what the opposite of Bowie would be, but just sort of.
There's definitely a confessional vibe to a lot of the way you're supposed to kind of perform now as an artist. Again, I've gotten this sense a lot lately, especially on social media or whatever, and you kind of almost get cajoled into sort of, you know, doling out like all of your past tragedies and traumas and sort of what's going on for you personally, because, you know, you're kind of trying to perform that authenticity for people to become valid or to, you know, to crowdfund your healthcare or whatever it is.
Well, I really want to get into this, though, this question of authenticity and, you know, if it really is, you know, that much better than artificiality. I know you invoke Oscar Wilde at one point in regards to this in the book.
He comes in a lot, actually. There's a whole chapter on him. And yeah, his work deals with that question kind of, I mean, that kind of runs through most of his work. But with authenticity, and I mean, it's so much about framing for me. I mean, there's easy ways to make something look like it's, you know, real or not real within any given context. So again, it's the appearance of truth or falsehood. And is that all there is? I mean, we need to be talking about something in particular to really answer that question, but, you know, like specific.
Can I get specific here for a second?
Yeah, sure.
So when I always hear about this debate about authenticity versus artificiality, I think of, okay, as an example, there's people that say, well, I'm not being edgy. I'm just, you know, being authentic to myself. This is the thing I want to say, no matter how horribly edgy it is.
Right.
And apparently that means the person who doesn't say the edgy thing, either because they don't believe it or maybe they don't want to hurt people by being, you know, edgy and mean-spirited.
Right.
Then I guess the implication is that they're less authentic. And yet maybe they authentically just don't want to do harm to people by being an edgelord.
That's, I mean, this is exactly what I'm saying, where it's about framing. And I think because both of those could be considered true, right? And who gets to decide that? And that becomes, you know, a battle of narratives, which is what we're dealing with, you know, kind of day in, day out on social media, to be sure. You know, everyone is kind of vying for staking their claim on reality with their framing of things. And then, you know, everyone else says they have a bad take, and it, you know, fuels the outrage economy forever, apparently.
It's such a weird moment, too, because I often find myself criticizing multiple sides. Mm-hmm. So it's like I'm very critical of mainstream media, but I'm also extremely critical of alternative or quote-unquote alternative and quote-unquote independent media.
Especially lately.
But I feel like, you know, almost everyone sort of has their narrative to push, either for social or maybe professional reasons or maybe even other reasons that, you know, are concealed by a mask.
Right. Or, you know, a lot of times it can be financial, you know, reasons, or at least it's, you know, motivated by financial elements. I mean, that becomes a big part of it, is just that, you know, it winds up coming down just to power. You know, who has the power to have more reach with their view than others? I mean, if it's true that the election that just went down in the UK was, you know, heavily conditioned by propaganda, you know, it's just a matter of who can amplify the most, who has the biggest bullhorn, you know? And if that's all we're dealing with, and that's all we've been dealing with, that's, I don't know, it's a problem. Because, you know, there's a lot of good that could be done by people that isn't driven by money interests, I'll put it that way.
Well, it's also interesting that you discuss in Masks, Bowie and Artists of Artifice, this shamanic quality that David Bowie has, specifically the great philosopher John Gray, who wrote the foreword to the book, sort of gets into this sort of shamanic element of Bowie. Maybe you could discuss that a little bit. You know, there's sort of a trickster thing going on with Bowie, and I think we often see that now in a lot of internet subcultures as well, this sort of trickster archetype.
Sure. I would say he was shaman-like. I mean, he certainly wasn't like a trained shaman, and even the term itself is sort of problematic in a sort of anthropological sense, but it still conveys the meaning that we're trying to give, which is that he kind of allowed people to take on roles that allowed them to like kind of break out of themselves and potentially even kind of change their reality. You know, obviously I don't mean that in the sort of, you know, Harry Potter sort of magic idea of, you know, changing reality, but it's still a funny thing because he described it as, you know, being in a car that's accelerating, you know, so fast that you think it's going to go out of control, you know? And I think I've felt that sense of vertigo, in his work, when I really was kind of taken by it. I think it's been, I mean, you said, you know, this kind of not the age of Bowie now, because it's become almost too ubiquitous. And that might be true. It's almost like he succeeded so much at, you know, sort of playing to the times or even, you know, changing the times that he's kind of, you know, disappeared from it. You know, like it's like people don't need to wear the mask anymore because everything is a mask, right?
That's I'm trying to wrap my head around that. It can lead, this can lead you down many different sort of avenues of thought. That's why it gets very interesting. That's why I like that it's the title is plural, masks, you know, mm-hmm. because there's
definitely, yeah, specifically plural. Yeah, if it was mask, I mean, that, of course, you know, I mean, people wouldn't notice, but, you know, that would be kind of implying a very different ontology. You know, it's like pluralism is, I mean, it really, if you're talking about Bowie, if you're taking him even at all seriously, kind of as a thinker, pluralism is definitely a big part of it. You know, it's, he was not really a big fan of the idea of, you know, central authority or a central authoritative truth, to be sure. Kind of a bit of a Gnostic, really.
You mean maybe Gnostic in the more popular sense as opposed to the sort of historical sense, like this sort of inner knowledge or?
Yeah, but definitely the sense that the world is sort of a fallen creation in the sense of like the demiurge, like God is not the highest.
Right, right. There's like, I believe within like the sort of modern day Gnostic mythos, there's sort of the true God force, and I don't know what its name is. Then there's also the demiurge, which is like
right.
this sub god that is actually insane because it's too powerful and is it right. has made the earth fallen.
Yeah, it's I mean it's kind of like the material world that we're trapped within. And I think he overtly played with those ideas a lot when he was, you know, kind of doing his occult thing in the Thin White Duke stuff, especially. You know, he gets into a lot of the Kabbalistic symbolism in it as well. But I'm sorry, I lost your original question because I got sidelined by the Gnosticism thing. That was kind of a throwaway line.
There was just one more thing I wanted to touch upon,
mm-hmm.
and that's Bowie's relationship to fame. Maybe we could talk a little bit about that because you seem to be fascinated by it in the book.
Yeah. I mean, I am. I think, you know, he tried to kind of, well, he was very, I mean, I couldn't say why he was so fixated on becoming famous, but in his early career, I mean, that was his, you know, kind of central goal was to, you know, become a thing, become an item. You know, and he got really good at marketing and sort of manipulating advertisers and, you know, the press to get that goal. But in the process, I think he also discovered the sort of, you know, cursed element of it. You know, this comes to mind a lot with like people like Kurt Cobain, where, you know, when I was younger and also when I was kind of more fixated on like, I'm become famous, but, you know, I was really interested in kind of making a mark as an artist. And I hear him saying in interviews kind of just, you know, bitching about how terrible it is to be famous and whatnot. And, you know, I when I was younger, I thought that's, you know, oh yeah, it sounds really terrible for you, you know, right? But then as you discover what it's actually like and how it kind of creates a sort of hothouse effect. And I mean, child stars are a great example of kind of what can happen, or, you know, what happens to child stars is a great example of this. Because, you know, they didn't have a chance to kind of form their own ego before their kind of popularity formed their ego for them. And that can lead to some real crack ups later on, you know, when that sort of monster kind of gets a life of its own. And, you know, like I said, luckily Bowie managed to kind of wrest his way out of it, but it's something all of us have to wrestle with, I think. You know, at least certainly all of us who are artists, but I mean, really all of us, just, you know, is kind of balancing our public and private life is really a big part of it. You know, in Japanese culture, it's the personal face and, you know, public face.
How did Bowie manage to do that? Was it over the course of like a long period of time, or did he have a sudden change after, you know, those coke-fueled days?
Yeah. In 75, 76, he kind of reached the limit of what his body and mind could take, and he fled and ultimately did what's called the Berlin Trilogy. It wasn't all recorded in Berlin, with Iggy Pop, and they managed to I wouldn't say he just like suddenly stepped out of the role, though. It wasn't like that. It was definitely a process. From that point until actually Ashes to Ashes, the video that he produced for it, he kind of reprises all of his old characters. And his idea with that, that was recorded in 1980, was to kind of put them to rest. But of course, it didn't do that. Even 33 years later, he's still doing, put out a video that's still dealing with the same characters and sort of, now it's from the perspective of an old man. But he was never able to kind of completely put them behind him, but he was able to kind of separate them out from himself, which is something kind of in the occultic frame. Like I said, it's along the lines of drawing a circle, which is just simply creating a barrier between one thing and the other thing, and then actually maintaining it psychically, which is the hard part.
Wasn't Bowie always pretty open with regards to his audience about telling them that what you're seeing on stage is a fictitious construct?
Yes and no. I mean, he liked playing with people. Like when he quote unquote killed Ziggy on stage, no one had been warned about that. This is going to be my final performance. I don't even think the band knew about it. At least not all of them did at the time. So can you imagine touring with someone, this kind of being your career and your whatever. And then it's suddenly like, oh, we're done. Okay. He killed the character, but for a little while, it wasn't clear that what he meant by that, are you ending your career? What does this mean? But it was just the end of Ziggy. And so he did like playing with audiences in that way, but in interviews and so on, he certainly kind of, at times, broke the fourth wall a little bit. Although even then, when he breaks the fourth wall, it oftentimes is in a way that kind of raises the question of is he breaking the fourth wall? Is he being himself now, or is this a new character?
I always found it fascinating that Bowie would go on in later years to portray Nikola Tesla in a movie called, I believe it was The Prestige, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I only saw it like when it first came out. But yeah, I do remember that.
I do find that interesting.
He played Warhol also in Basquiat, which was not a very successful film, but his role was still really good in it. His relationship with Warhol is kind of funny. He wrote a song about Andy Warhol, which apparently Andy Warhol didn't like at all. So go figure.
Well, the reason I mentioned The Prestige is in a way, prestige in the original sense of the term, which is really prestige, is sort of another word for illusion. I think it says a lot about David Bowie, just the title of that movie. Yeah.
It's like a Wizard of Oz kind of thing. Yeah.
Well, I think we can apply that to the real world too, because your book got me to thinking about the illusions we have in everyday life. I look at people who we consider prestigious, like say Peter Thiel or an Elon Musk, and they have to be just the smartest people in the room and the smartest people in the whole world. And I've often said to people and gotten pushback for it, I've often said, well, what if they aren't? What if they're actually like normal human beings and have like similar foibles to the rest of us? Like what if our leaders aren't necessarily like the dark Illuminati conspirators in a room of like five families? What if that's not the case? What if they're just like normal people with foibles, and we create this sort of prestigious image that people of fame and fortune and power are actually more than they really are?
A cult of personality. Certainly. Yeah. I mean, I think, if people who are kind of good at working it and have that certain amount of power might surround themselves with people or, have enough help that they can kind of create the kind of seamless performance of, kind of perfection. But of course, everyone is, we're all just somewhat hairless apes.
Yeah. But we sort of see it in our daily lives, and we're all performing in it. The ways we dress usually is a social indicator to let people know, I'm sort of from this background or that background. Even the ways we talk. I mean, I think this whole idea of masks and artifice that you deal with in regards to Bowie really applies beyond even art itself in some ways.
We get into it, or at least I get into it a lot about, you know, about social media as well, and, you know, kind of our performance through brands. You know, and a lot of times you can see this, you know, out in the wild of the internet, of people, you know, kind of positioning who they are by the media they consume and what they think about the media they consume. And of course, some of that's natural, but it also is, you know, somewhat telling when we're kind of living in this sort of consumerist, I don't want to reuse the word hothouse, but it's appropriate. You know, we're all kind of performing at each other through also telling each other what we should be buying and, you know, based on quote unquote who we are. But who we are is just, you know, becomes a sort of reflection of the things we consume.
See, this is not the dystopia that we ordered. I thought we were going to get Blade Runner instead.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I was actually saying earlier today that this cyberpunk dystopia is not quite what I, you know, had in mind. Cyberpunk 2077 video game is coming out soon, and I'm looking forward to it. But another way, I'm kind of like, is this, you know, how different is it going to really be from what we're already dealing with? But somehow it's more fun when you play it in a video game than actually living in it.
Real quick, I'm just curious, since we sort of got into current events, do you see any parallels or contrasts between, say, David Bowie and maybe like a Donald Trump?
I definitely think that like politically Bowie would be, you know, on the opposite side. But in terms of, definitely in terms of the sense of kind of creating the sort of, you know, fiction. I mean, Trump, you know, like there's all these sort of images that are shared by his followers that are, you know, God Emperor Dune Trump, and, you know, he's just like a massive warrior, and, you know, he's so strong. Like, look at the guy. He's, I mean, you know, I'm not gonna fat shame him, but he's not a warrior.
You know? I mean, also, if you talk to anyone that was from the New York area, he's sort of considered like a laughing stock.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly, you know, a psychological element to him trying to show everyone up, you know. I mean, I'm sure that was probably, he had in 2000 where he had an interest in running. This has been on his mind for a while, you know, and I'm sure part of that is this sense of kind of trying to show everyone how big and strong he is. So
I just think it's interesting because I think very few people have gotten at who Donald Trump actually is beyond the sort of masks that he may wear. Although I don't know what may be underneath.
Right, exactly. And that's my sense of him, in a way, is that there really isn't anyone underneath. And especially if you buy into the whole concept of him being a narcissist, you know, in a clinical sense. And, you know, I could argue either way on that. But, you know, certainly if that is the case, that part of that kind of psyche is to not really have anything, you know, going on behind it. You know, as I said, to a certain extent, that's true of all of us, but mental illness tends to be a heightened or, you know, exaggerated form of what's common to everyone. It's not like something completely unique. We're all a little bit narcissistic.
Well, I guess in closing, what would you like listeners to get out of Masks, Bowie and Artists of Artifice, if they can pick it up when it's released? I believe January 15th, yeah, 2019.
It's the same month as his birth and the same month as his death, which I'd like to say that was planned by marketing or whatever, but it was completely coincidental. I would say, I mean, for me, I kind of was immediately hit with these concepts about all the things we've been talking about right around his death, and I wanted to explore them and in relation to my own work. And, you know, what followed was several years of kind of intensive studying and writing about that. So, I mean, my hope is that other people, whether artists or otherwise, want to take that same trip, or their version of it. You know, that's kind of why I'm doing it. I did it as a, you know, it's kind of an adjunct, in a way. It's like the nonfiction companion to the fiction work I've been doing. You know, graphic novels and illustrated novels and that sort of thing. But it certainly informed my process. And I think it could be really informative to other artists as well, and writers and, you know, people, artists. I use artists in the kind of most broad sense imaginable, really.
Well, hey, Jamie, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. If you can, Let my listeners know how they can get a hold of Masks or how they can check out any of your other work.
Well, you can, I have a website at jamescursio.com, but Mask itself, you can find at the publisher's website, Intellect Books, or you can find it on Amazon. You type in Masks Bowie, it'll come up.
And again, thank you, James Curcio, for coming on Parallax Views.
Yeah, it's good talking to you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with James Curcio, and I hope you consider checking out his new book, Masks, Bowie and Artists of Artifice, available now from Intellect Books. Let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Also, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon, where you can hear archived editions of past Parallax Views programs, as well as the Parallax Views current events program, The Week That Was. As always, stay safe and wash those hands. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.